Let's get back to Broadway for a minute. I don't think I've ever met anybody that has a greater knowledge of Broadway and the history of Broadway than you do, David. And I'm so pleased to have made your acquaintance.
Well, I can introduce you to a few people who know a lot more than I do, but thank you.
But you're educating me every time we get together. And I will again thank you for exposing me again. I had known about it before, but Sunset Boulevard, which actually we're going to see tonight down at
they're
the
Madison. They're doing it in Arvada, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I can't wait to see it. But I love that album. I have listened to it so many times. And it's, to me, that's what musical theater should be. It's so beautiful.
What do you mean?
I think it, not necessarily that it needs to be a motion picture made into it, but the music telling the story, and that's one of the things I like best about Andrew Lloyd Webber. Mm. I think, aside from Cats, which I'm not a real fan of, but I do think that Phantom was very much like that. And regardless of whose production you see or whose version of Phantom you see, even if you go back in retro to the Claude Rains motion picture,
yeah,
the Phantom of the Opera.
Or the Lon Chaney one, yeah.
Again, you still are seeing it, or you are experiencing it with some elements of Andrew Lloyd Webber's presentation of it, because you the music is different and everything is different, but you're still I hesitate to say comparing it to, because that's not fair, but you do have a feeling of familiarity from Andrew Lloyd Webber's that goes back to that. You say, oh, that's where that came from.
Oh, okay,
that's
yeah.
how they. That's how that evolved. I don't know if you've seen the Claude Rains film. I think it's 52.
Herbert Lom did it. And, you know,
Academy Award winner for its set decoration, though, the Claude Rains one. And if you look at it, it was a very well-produced film.
Yeah.
And Claude Rains never did a bad performance in his life. I'm sure he never did. Even some of the most despicable characters he ever got stuck with, he did a marvelous job in depicting them, so... Now, about Broadway theater.
Yeah.
My first exposure, and I told you this before,
yeah.
was West Side Story. And my father and mother took us to see it because we were staying at the Taft Hotel in New York City. And we could see from the dining room the painting on the side, you know, the promotional poster on the side of the building next to it. And my parents took us to see that. And you remember Carol Lawrence is the only one I remember.
Well, I never saw her in it. But, yeah,
but
okay,
she was
yeah.
Maria.
Right.
And that, and I remember I couldn't believe because I'd never seen anything like that. What am I, 10 years old?
Wow.
And I was just blown away. And just the feeling of being in that, and it was crowded. It was very, very crowded. Just the feeling of being there. And I'm so in awe of your knowledge of it, but your opportunity and experience to have gone to those things. How many Broadway shows have you seen, David?
Thank you for asking, Gil. I feel like this is your show, and I'm just kind of guesting here. I love it. Thousands. Because, I mean, I had the opportunity. I was born in New York. I'm a New Yorker until a year ago when I moved out to Greeley, Colorado with my lovely wife, Joyce. So if you figure I started, I mean, I saw a couple of shows when I was a kid. So, of course, I think my first Broadway show was The Magic Show. Makes sense because the kids are, you know.
Is that right?
Kids with Doug Henning, if you remember him.
Yes.
And they also took me, of course, to Fiddler on the Roof a couple of times. So I did get to see
Whose version?
I saw Zero. I think I saw Zero twice. Once when I was too young to even...
You know, they ought to bronze you and put you in the window. That was... people would kill to see that performance.
Yeah. And I did see him, and I do remember this, towards the end of his, like the last stage of that last Fiddler that he did. So that is a memory. I do recall him. And I remember... The thing I remember most about Zero Mostel and Fiddler on the Roof, not from obviously the record albums or seeing clips of him, but from seeing him in person... was actually intermission, because we knew he was old, and we knew he was not well. And suddenly, at intermission, the announcer comes on, and everybody in the audience was holding their breath, because we figured, oh no, Zero's going to, you know, they're going to get the understudy for the second act. And it turned out to be an announcement about, I forget, it wasn't cell phones back then, of course, but it had nothing to do with that. It was like, if your lights are on and the could you please turn that off, or whatever it was, or you have 5 minutes left before intermission was over. And literally, the whole auditorium exhaled when we realized, oh, Zero's coming back. We're going to see him.
What was the theater? Which theater do you remember?
Oh, I have to look that up. But we're talking, you know, 1970s at this point.
Wow.
I'm pretty sure of it.
We saw Herschel Bernardi do that out in California in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of what you think of his interpretation, I thought he was marvelous. But, you know, that's a show that's hard to do a bad job at.
It really is. I mean, I ended up seeing Topol, who did it on Broadway years back. He was very good. But the joke of that production was, because he's Topol, and he takes all his moments, a three-hour show is actually 3.5.
Yeah.
I don't mind. It's Fiddler. I don't mind 3.5 hours of Fiddler on the Roof. And then Alfred Molina did it about 5 years ago. And that was actually a very nice production. Not the ideal, but it was really nice.
Let me ask you this. You've been to a lot of local theaters here. Now, you've been here a year. You and I have been together once, and we saw Bye Bye Birdie last week over at Raj and Kathy's place at the Union Colony Dinner Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is less than a question and more than an observation.
Yeah.
But I think that there is something magic, too, about local theater, which oftentimes is overlooked. People don't go to see local theater because they say, I've already seen Zero Mostel or Herschel Bernardi or somebody else do that. But, you know, there are interpretations of those shows that have not even been scratched the surface yet. And some people who may never have seen those performances have their own idea of what it should be, and it's fascinating to watch that. I think we have some wonderful local theaters here, not the least of which, as I mentioned, here right in Greeley, right over here on 9th, is the Union Colony Dinner Theater, and I have Raj and Kathy on regularly. In fact, tomorrow morning I will have the director of the next show that's coming up. It's the Patsy Cline.
Always Patsy Cline.
Yeah, Always Patsy Cline, and his name is Joel Chavez, and he has a middle name. I think it's Adams, but he wants to use all three. And then Kathy's daughter is going to be there, too, Tori Richardson, and she's there, and she does the lights and sound and things for him over there. But, you know, this is a situation, and I think that these smaller theaters, particularly these kind of things, give an opportunity to young people, as we might have liked to have had when we were younger. Right. Now, I did do some melodrama stuff like that, and I suppose you probably did some dinner theater, too, yourself, didn't you, David?
Well, I'm not much of an actor, a singer-dancer.
Neither am I.
I can carry a folk tune, but I cannot carry musical theater. Do not dance. Yeah.
I would love to see you act, though, because you have a presence about you, which I am really impressed with. Almost from the first time we met over at the Stampede, I said, you know, this fella has something, and I really wanted to get to be...
Well, penicillin cured that.
So yeah, right, yeah. Okay. Let's laugh it all up. But here, you have so many... I think you're a lot deeper than you believe you are.
Oh, I'm tremendously deep.
At any rate, we do have a group of people who kind of travel around to these theaters, and they're very good, and some of them one day are going to be names that we'll have to be reckoned with. I think of Scott Wright, who is one of my favorite people. He's been out at Candlelight for some time, but he'll be doing Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat over here at Union Colony for the Christmas presentation. I think of Sharon Sheets, who does shows everywhere, and she's been at Carousel, she's been at Candlelight, she's done shows over here for Raj and Kathy at Union Colony. We really are fortunate to have those three here. And as opposed to looking at them as competition, which I think they do look at each other as competition, I look at them as each having a different place in my experience of theater, and I look forward to every opportunity I get to go. Now, take that one step further, and this is something I'm going to invite you to go to with me in the near future, because I have season tickets there too, is the Windsor Community Playhouse.
Sweet.
I have been involved with them for nigh on to 12 years. I am no longer really doing acting, directing, those kind of things. I was a narrator for their vaudeville, but we've done some wonderful plays over there, things that people don't recognize that would be available through a community theater. And where I was taking this all goes back to their individual appreciations of Broadway theater, legitimate theater, traveling companies, and so on, because they see South Pacific and they say, gee, I'd love to play that part, and that the community theater gives them an opportunity to do it. If they're successful in community theater, many of them, as we've noted with the three dinner theaters here in our localities, gives them the opportunity to take that a step further. Someday there's going to be, I won't say a Laurence Olivier, but perhaps a Charlton Heston come out of one of those, not necessarily from the standpoint of film, but the theater, I think, is making its umpteenth millionth revival because legitimate theater is really becoming more popular again, I think.
There's a lot of different elements in what you just said. I mean, I think it is great that if you have people coming out of UNC and our very fine theater and music program, and you've got people coming out of UC Boulder and places like that. They don't just have to, they graduate, and now what?
Yeah.
They just moved to New York. And you know, there was actually an article in Backstage about 2 weeks ago was saying that essentially, yeah, if you want to, there isn't that much to do in Colorado, especially if you want to do film or if you want to be on TV commercials, you kind of have to get out.
Yeah.
But for those who want to stick around and stay for a bit, you know, there, you know, it's not just, oh, okay, UNC, and then you try and audition for something at the Denver Center. Is there anything in between? And thank goodness, at least Gridley has a couple of things, and then if you move towards Loveland and Fort Collins, and there are theaters there. Mm. You're talking about some of the more commercial theaters. There are, of course, theaters that do not just musicals or dinner theater,
yeah,
but you know, a little bit more of like off-Broadway plays and things like that, and thank you God know, for them.
And there's another venue, too, that I just recently been exposed to. It's called The Dinner Detective, and it's a fellow named Steve Wilder down in Denver. Mm-hmm. And it's a he bought the franchise for all of Colorado. He's been on the show with me a couple of times on Senior Circle. We went to one of their performances over at the Hilton, and it's the murder mystery dinner, the typical thing.
My wife loves those.
Well, by golly, the next time we get a chance to go, I'm going to take you guys along, because let me tell you what Steve has done with us. And I don't know if it came with him from Los Angeles, but he has a tremendously talented group of improvisational actors that are in his troupe. They embed the actors into the audience. So you don't know if that person sitting next to you is really one of the actors or really one of the patrons to the show. Now, this is fascinating to me. And you know, I absolutely adore Steve because he's been so generous with his time to come do my radio show. But from the first time we got on the show together, and he was telling me about this hook that they have of putting the actors in the audience, I'm thinking, I've got to see this. Because most dinner theater, you have the characters.
Right.
And we've done a ton of these things. I think you and I have talked about this before. Those are fun. That's really great because the actors then pull the audience into it. But picture this for a moment. You walk in there, and the actors are really sitting with you. They're in the socializing portion of the beginning. You get to know them, and you think, oh, this is Bob so-and-so, and he sells parts for Napa, except he's not. He's really an actor. And they give you fictitious names, or you choose a fictitious name at the beginning of the show. So everyone then field is at a level, and you don't know. But what it does is it brings out the best in the audience because they start to participate more than they might if this were just a group of iconic characters that were in the thing. And he's doing these in Boulder. He's doing them in Denver. He's doing them in Fort Collins, and it's really great. It's thedinnerdetective.com if you want to see it out on the internet. Thedinnerdetective.com. They've got a wonderful one coming up. I'm sorry to say they're all sold out down in Denver, but they have one coming up, I think, on Halloween, and there will be a group of them at the Hilton over in Fort Collins. Betty and I would love to go that, but here's the switch on that one. Everyone shows up in costume. Now, think of that.
Are you actually going to do that? Do you have a costume picked out?
I would like to do you know, the Orson Welles classic Chimes at Midnight Falstaff. I was good to do that. But I think they may be sold out. I'd have to check on that again. Betty and I were talking about going to do that, but then of course I'm working that night. Halloween is on Sunday this year.
Yeah,
but that's great. Anyhow, we're getting away from this. What I was going to go to though is that you know, musical comedy is the only specifically American form of theater. It originated in this country, not somewhere else, because it's been copied elsewhere. And we have such a rich heritage of those things. Having been born and grew up in New York and being able to see those, as you mentioned, with Fiddler, how many others have you been able to see a one-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see the great names in theater?
And if I had been born 20 years earlier.
Well, yeah, you could have seen Barrymore. You could have seen Burton and some of those.
Not just Barrymore. I mean, the great years of the American musical theater were late 40s into 50s. So
Oklahoma.
I missed some of the major shows, and I didn't start going to theater as a grown-up, because I only went it's not like my parents took me to the theater every week. I went to a couple of shows when I was a kid, but then it wasn't until college in the early 80s that I started to say, okay, you know, I'm into this. I want to be a film director. I want to be a writer. I want to be this and that. So, you know, Wednesday afternoons when they had the cheapest tickets, I would zoom down to the TKTS line after my physics class. Ugh. And see whatever I could. But by then, I mean, that was actually considered sort of a waning period in Broadway. I had really missed most of the Golden Age.
And I think you're right. It was almost a waning, as you said, period.
But I got to see later, not in the original incarnations, but Carol Channing do Hello, Dolly. That was kind of nice. She can. It wasn't that long ago.
I am so jealous. Ago, yeah.
And that what you understood what she brought to that part.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't a kid anymore. She was an old. It was obviously tailored for her to do it one more time. And there is a possibility in like 2 or 3 weeks. I don't want to jinx it, but I'm probably going to be interviewing Carol Channing on this show in October.
Really?
Yeah. Seriously. Really. Really. Really.
Do you tape these?
I'm trying to. I'm hoping that the MP3 is working. But yes, I'm going to totally take it.
Oh, David, you know, after you've done that interview. In fact, you know, I'd love to see you come over and do my senior circle once a month, and we could just talk a little bit. We can afford one segment of 11 minutes to talk about what you're doing over here. But golly, you have got such a rich background in theater. I think that does UNC know how lucky they are to have you?
No, I wish they did. Kind of wish that. Well,
in other words, you're not overpaid, right?
To the other topic, yeah. Well, but well, other people, you know, like a friend of mine, former old friend of mine, he saw, or maybe his parents saw Yul Brynner like King two nights before he passed, but they got to see him, you know? That I missed.
He died on the same day as Orson Welles did. Did you know that?
Nope, that I did not know. Yeah. So,
you know, he was terrific, Yul Brynner, because, you know, he sold the world a bill of goods. He was nothing like what his...
Yeah.
Legend was. I mean, he was born in New York City, but
oh my God, I always thought he was Turkish or something.
No,
like that. Yeah.
His mother was a hooker, and he evolved this character. Go back and watch a 1946 film called Ports of New York, and he has the villain lead in that, and you will never, ever, ever recognize him. But what was the lady that played Anna in The King? The part was essentially written for her. I want to see Gertrude Lawrence.
Yeah, okay.
And she literally took him off the streets after he had miserably failed in what he thought was going to be a movie career. And his physical being was in such terrible... I mean, he had rickets, something terrible. If you take a look at the film, you can even see, you know, his legs were terribly misformed. But she put him on a regimen of exercise and food and got him going, and she sold him to Rodgers and Hammerstein as the only person she would play the part with. There's great stories out there, and none of them are from his son, which that's a horror. You talk about Mommy Dearest. This was almost as bad a book as Mommy Dearest. But he was a pretty admirable character. He sold the world a whole bill of goods. You know, he was the son of a Japanese acrobat and Russian dethroned aristocracy.
No, people believed it. I still don't know until right now.
I haven't read
his or any books about.
Well, there's been a lot of books out there, but one of my favorite stories about him, if you don't mind my saying, though, is when he was doing Magnificent Seven, and you remember the young Steve McQueen came in there with. You know, he was the next big star going to be coming to films and stuff like that. And Steve McQueen, according to – and this was an interview that was done with Yul Brynner. He said he was a scene stealer. And if he was off, you know, slightly off camera or something, he was always grabbing at flies or taking his hat off or something to take attention away from the lead players. Well, if you remember the beginning of that piece where they have – and he's talking to the drummer and they're going to drive the hearse up to Boot Hill, he and Steve McQueen. Yeah. And Steve McQueen's – fooling around, and you know, well, Yul Brynner's supposed to have a line there, right?
Yeah.
So Yul Brynner says, "Cut," you know, and you know, the director says, "What's this about?" And he says, "I just need a moment." And he took Steve McQueen aside and he said, "Now this is going to stop right here.
Good, yeah.
Because all I've got to do is take off my hat, and you're out of the seat."
Good for him. I thought he was going to punch him or something.
No.
Wonderful. That's great.
You know, he was married on the set of Magnificent Seven. That little festival that they had was actually the party for their wedding. That's his, I think, his third wife.
I've got to do a little bit of business here.
I know. I don't mean to bore you here. I could do that, though, if you gave me half a chance.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll give you a whole chance to do that. But let's not bore people with the wonderful folks who sponsor this radio station. We are a not-for-profit station.
Have a sponsor?
Well...
Congratulations!
Oh, thanks for reminding me. I actually have my own sponsors.
Those are hard to get.
You got yours. People can't even advertise on your shows because you're all booked.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to say I am, but, you know, I'm a niche show.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so many... old people out there. We're getting older all the time. So. Well, but thank you for saying that, Dave. I want to know who your sponsors are, David.
Well, let's see. My personal sponsors were Dave's Gone By, and they've been with me pretty much since the beginning when I was doing this show in 2002 back on New York radio. They include Hewlett Minuteman Press, the Copy Kings of Broadway, owned by the Torong family since the mid-1970s. Everything you need done at a copy place. There's copying, there's printing. They can put your name or your logo on a mug, on a pencil, on a binder. Hewlett Minuteman Press. Call them at 516-569-5577. 516-569-5577. And tell them Dave sent you to get 10% off any job, big or small, at Minuteman in Hewlett. Yes, I'm still actually, this is how loyal my sponsors are.
That's wonderful.
Colorado.
That's wonderful. And they're in New York?
Yeah. Yeah, they're in Long Island.
What, they have a website?
Yes, they do. MinutemanPress@att.net. I'm pretty sure that's correct. If not,
and you say they will put my logo, they will put my logos on cups?
Well, you have to pay them.
Well, yeah, I expected to.
But at reasonable prices, good turnaround time, and they do very good work. They're good people. So, yeah, they can put, let's say you wanted to do something for Golden Years Theater or your name or you're licensing something, you know, they'll put it on a mug. They'll put it on.
Have to write that down, Minuteman Press.
Yeah.
And what was the telephone number again, David?
516-569-5577. And tell them Dave sent you for 10% off. Program is also brought to you by Fancy Schmancy Balloons. My friend Jeff, who was co-host of Dave's Gone By for about a year or so back in New York, he has run Fancy Schmancy Balloons for about two decades now, and it's not just making balloons or these helium things. He will design your party to make it look amazing. It's about centerpieces and about balloon archways. And he can also, if you don't know the first thing about setting up a party, he'll find the DJ. He'll find the florist for you. He'll find the caterer. So check out Jeff. His number is 516-797-3229. Area code 516-797-3229. Shouldn't your party be a fancy schmancy event? And this program is brought to you by Performing Arts Insider Theater Journal, the Bible of Broadway, since 1944. Anything that you need to know about what's happening on the stages of New York, Broadway, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway, even cabaret and opera, check out Performing Arts Insider. Go to performingartsinsider.com for more information about that. Okay, now I've done my sponsors. I shouldn't have grouped these all together, but bear with me. We want to thank at UNC Radio, Reds, Dogs, and Donuts, which is welcoming back UNC students for the fall season. Visit Reds for hand-forged, delicious spud nuts.
You know, they're a sponsor over on KFK, too.
Are they really?
I did a spot for them. They were talking about spud nuts, and they asked me, what's a spud nut?
What is a spud nut?
It's a potato-based donut. Yeah.
Oh.
And they go back to, I think those were probably pre-World War II. I would guess if not pre, it was certainly in the time frame. But, you know, goods were hard to get in that time, and somebody developed a donut that was based on potatoes.
See, they've written this kind of punctuation errors wrong, because right after spud nuts, they say a potato donut, as if that is something else. But apparently a spud nut
is a potato donut. Yes, but they used to call potatoes spuds.
I still do sometimes. They also have foot-long hot dogs. I don't know if those are hand-forged. Buffalo dogs. And Kobe beef dogs, okay. And beverage-wise, they have chai smoothies, delicious caramel apples. That is not a beverage. You'd probably choke to death if you tried to drink that. Much more. They also have happy hour Monday through Thursday at 7 to 8 p.m. If you buy three spud nuts, you get three more free. I don't know why I find that so amusing. And let's see, is the poker... yesterday was the poker tournament, so I don't have to read that.
Do you ever eat there?
I've never tried. Is it good?
Let's go there this afternoon. I'll buy.
Okay, well...
After we're done here?
The one thing that I was curious about, and by the way, we're here, it's 11:58 in the morning. We're almost coming up on noon here at UNC Radio in Northern Colorado. The one thing I was worried about getting you here on the air this morning is, don't you have to be in your tent or something at the Oktoberfest?
Well, that's up to whenever I get there is fine. But, you know, I don't have a specific set time. I'll just go by there on my way back. I'm not a big star over there. You know, we do have the Luke Schiltz and the Amy Olivers and the George Grays and and those people who are far more important than I am. And I'm sure I can get over there anytime I want to. But I would like to, I'd like to go over there. I was hoping you'd have lunch with me after we get done here because I'd love to talk with you a little bit more.
Well, I would love, actually, I'm meeting the famous Joyce down over by the Oktoberfest.
Okay, so well, we'll do it.
Come time. With us, and we'll grab some brats and brews.
Love to, yeah.
Wonderful.
I can't think of anybody I'd rather spend time with. But honestly, I have to tell you, those are really good dogs. And if you, I'm not what you would call a connoisseur. Now, you probably haven't gone to Yankee Stadium and some of those. We just had, you know, Candlesticks out there in California. But these hot dogs are reminiscent to some extent of the ballpark hot dogs, but they're better. And they really are unique. There's a lot of choice there.
Is there actual meat in them?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, that's what they tell you. You know, I've spent a lot of time in the Far East, the Middle East, and one of the things I was told early on is chew three times and swallow it, and don't ask what it is.
Oh, well, I would remember this.
That's one thing you don't have to worry about that with right. Days with Red's dogs and donuts. I never worried about what was in those because I know that they're the best that you could get. And like I say, I did cut a commercial for them over at KFK. I was pleased to have been asked to do so.
Oh, very nice. Yeah.
We'll go over there one of these times. I'll tell you what, you get the lovely and talented Joyce, and we'll go over there and do that.
That sounds good to me.
It's a good place.
It's one of those places. One thing that I guess the listeners
and you need to be able to try one of those spud nuts, you know, David. They're really, really good.
I wouldn't miss it. I wouldn't miss a potato donut. I mean, come on.
They're good.
Yeah. But, no, the thing is, Joyce and I, one thing we haven't had, even living a year in Colorado, we still haven't bought a car. So we are kind of centrally located around UNC and around this area. Haven't, unfortunately, been able to get to places like theaters in Denver as much as I'd like to, or in Fort Collins. So that's why when you say, well, you've been to all the theaters around here, haven't as much as I should, and as much as I encourage all the listeners to go out and support our community theaters, our local theaters in Greeley and, you know, in northern Colorado in general. Because, you know, to keep it going, they need your patronage, they need your money.
They do. I have. Yeah, let me tell a real quick story here, David.
Yeah.
Last week when we were there at Union College Dinner Theater to see Bye Bye Birdie. You remember there was a young man I introduced you to after the show that his name was Michael McBeth. And he started doing...
Wait, his last name is...
Macbeth, yes.
Wow.
Is that great? Yeah, obviously. But Michael is one of those ones that you never forget because we did the first show, he was saying that. I think he was 13 or 14 the first time he did Encore, which is a Christian-based theatrical group over in Fort Collins. Mm-hmm. It was actually started by seven women, and it continues to this day. A couple of the originals are still involved in it, but it's they do shows now once a year. They've been doing them at the Rialto the last couple of years, and I think they're going to do one at the Drake Center.
Is this in Denver?
No, it's in Fort Collins. But Michael was one of the youngsters that started doing that with us back when we were performing at the Lincoln Center. We used to get I think it's called the New Horizons Room or something there. And we did several shows. In fact, Phil Walker, the great Phil Walker from KCOL, he and I did My Fair Lady, a segment of My Fair Lady together. I was Pickering and he was...
Liza? No.
Yeah, he was cute little Liza. No, Phil Walker. You know, Phil was quite instrumental. He and Bill Benton were instrumental in getting me back into radio after I'd been gone for well over 30 years.
I'm talking to Gil Moon. He is radio broadcaster on KFKA AM 1310, which you can listen to if you're in Colorado on the regular radio at 1310 on your AM dial or on the internet at 1310kfka.com. And you can listen to Gil's two programs on the station. Sunday morning at 10, he hosts Senior Circle. And then Sunday evenings from 6 to 10 Mountain Time, you can hear Golden Years Theater with tons of wonderful old-time radio. But again, Gil, you're saying about...
Well, I was just going to say that Phil Walker, we were talking about theater and the evolution of it. Actually, Dave, if you go back to it, wouldn't it have been nice when we were kids to be able to have, if it had been, you know, so approved of, at least in my case, that we could have gone, say, from high school to college, done some college things here, then go on to maybe a dinner theater or out in California, there's, you know, the melodramas. Those are still pretty big. There's one in San Luis Obispo. There's one in Paso Robles and some other places there. But they're kind of novelty deals. They're not really as much as what we have here, let's say, with those things. would have been great to have. But I tell you, I was tickled, and you recall from last Saturday night how tickled I was to see Michael doing a production there. There's another fellow, Seth Jakowski, who's done a lot of stuff locally here that was one of our encore players that moved on, and he's been at Union Colony for some time, and he's done shows over at Carousel as well over there for Kurt. But it's theater, and we're very fortunate, I think, to have that variety of theater here in northern Colorado, just Fort Collins and Greeley and Loveland and so on. You know, I don't know if you've ever been to the Rialto yet over there in Loveland, but that's an old movie theater that they've converted. We did, and I have a small production company called Stellar Multimedia.
Okay.
And we have been producing for about 9 years shows called Radio Readers Theater.
Mm-hmm.
2 years ago, we did 4 radio programs over there, and we had the likes of, Don Krause was in it, and George Flynn, and a number of well-known actors and celebrities here from the area. A lot of them are radio personalities, and we reenact these old radio programs. We actually started doing these at the Windsor Community Playhouse, and we did War of the Worlds. We did It's a Wonderful Life. We did African Queen.
Do you have a sound effects person with you?
We make it. I do the sound effects, and then I have somebody who runs them, you know, live when we're doing them. But they're done on CDs, and I try to get
them in. Right, okay.
And he does the cues for them. His name's Duffy Lodick. And he's been with me from the beginning. But where I was going with this is that you mentioned about the radio, the old-time radio and the theater and stuff. When we originally started doing these, it was kind of a chancy thing because we weren't sure people were going to be willing to stand there and watch us read these things. You know, War of the Worlds was sold out almost every performance we did. And It's a Wonderful Life, when we did it for Christmas, we packed them in there. We had to run 2 more performances, and several nights we had to put extra chairs over there at Windsor Community Playhouse. The point is that people recognized what you called the magic earlier on about having to be participants as opposed to observers. We gave them a little bit of the best of both. And this is, I think, fascinating, that when we did the show 2 years ago over there with Don, and Don Krause helped me because he directed the Shadow episode for us. And Don Krause is a marvelous director. He does a lot of work for Bob Blue Theater over there in Fort Collins. We did 4 shows. We did One Man's Family. And we did, well, you wouldn't recognize it, but it was another Carlton E. Morris, and it was the longest-running soap opera on radio. And it was marvelous because you follow the Barber family who lived in Pacific Heights, San Francisco. And then we did George and Gracie with, what was his name, Sam Spade. Howard Duff is the guest, but he played the Sam Spade character. And then we did the Shadow episode, and then we finished off with the very first Superman episode. We sold 429 seats out of 450.
There's an interest in it. If you want to look at the other side of it, it's like the people who would go see Rocky Horror, the movie.
Exactly.
And then it wasn't just about seeing a film. It was about seeing...
experience.
Yeah. I totally understand that. And there is a theater. If you go back to New York, there's an off-Broadway theater that is doing radio theater.
Is that right?
Like for Halloween, they're doing some Edgar Allan Poe stories adapted in Reader's Theater kind of thing. They're doing Radio Macbeth. I hope.
Wow.
How many times have we said that name? We've said it twice.
Or yeah.
We jinxed it yet. I forget what. I think it's called Radio Theater New York is their website. So
wow.
If you're next time you happen to go back to my old stomping grounds, you might want to be checking.
Listen,
that
David,
out.
That's one of my plans. You know, is to twice a year go back, and I'd like to spend a week and see as much theater. What do you consider the best Broadway show you ever saw?
Oh my God.
See, that's like asking me what's my favorite movie, right?
Yeah, and you know, it's the kind of that you wish you had preparation on, because some people might be able to answer it, oh, yes, that right there. And then other times, well, this was good for this, and that was good.
See, that's where I would be.
Yeah.
This was good for cinematography, this was good for costumes, this was good for acting, and that's how I would be. It's hard to find one,
I can think of incredibly memorable moments in the theater that just blew my mind. I mean,
Tell me about it.
First of all, seeing a show called Full Moon. This is about 15
That's appropriate.
Years ago. Thank you so much. Well, let me tell you who was in this. It was a mime show put on by Bill Irwin. Now, you'll know who he is. He's an actor. And a very fine mime came up from San Francisco.
Certainly, yes. Yeah, he's a very famous name in San Francisco.
Oh, well, he should be, yeah.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of different mime things in New York, and he got, I think, a full, you know, this incredible genius grant and worked on stuff. But this, he teamed with a fellow named David Shiner, who came out of Cirque du Soleil.
Uh-huh.
And they teamed up on a mime show together where they each did different bits and different scenes. And Shiner did some of his Cirque du Soleil stuff. And Irwin incorporated the things that he was doing from largely New York and, you know, In Praise of Flight and his early stuff. And it was one of the funniest 2.5 hours I have ever spent. And it was funny and it was beautiful to watch. It was, if you ever get to see Full Moon, do so.
Now, is that a touring company too?
Or? Well, I mean, we're going about 15 years, and it won't have toured. It would have had to have been then, you know, doing it. But you can see bits and pieces. Like, if you, there are things that Bill Irwin has done that have been videoed, or first time I saw David Shiner do the routine that is now quite famous of the photographer in the photography studio. Have you ever seen this?
I don't believe I have, no.
It was done, I probably saw it on HBO when they taped a Cirque du Soleil thing. Because he was part of Cirque du Soleil at that point.
Yeah.
And he was the clown. And he came out, but he wasn't in clown makeup or anything like that. He was just in like a hat and kind of an old-time suit. And he played a photographer with a fake, big old fake camera. And he got four people out of the audience to play people who were going to be in this silent movie. And he, you know, he sets up this little set of what they had to do. It was a Western, and there's the girl, and then there's the villain, and then there's the guy. One of the absolute fall-down funniest things you have ever seen in your life. And they incorporated that into Full Moon as well. So I got to see it, like, I mean, just screamingly funny. So that is an unusual thing to pick for, like, a favorite Broadway moment, because it's not a big musical. And
it's fairly obscure, but, you know, nonetheless, that doesn't detract from the quality of it. You know, you mentioned mime. San Francisco is, you know, is a world center for some of the finest mimes there ever were. Most people remember Shields and Yarnell from back in the 70s. They had their own television show for some time. But you know, there's a fellow by the name of Robin Williams that used to do mime in San Francisco at Union Square. And when I was working there for one of the large drug companies in downtown San Francisco, it was not unusual for us to go over there and, you know, and get, it's usually bagels, but there were hot dogs and things like that too around.
Not as good as Red Dog's hot dogs.
Not even close. Yeah. But as you sit around on the park benches and stuff like that, and the lunch hour in San Francisco, most people think that it probably runs extended, but most often it's very, very close to noon to one. But if you're loose enough that you can take your lunch a little earlier, a little later, you can see some unique situations over there. And I do remember, and this was one of those things that really stuck in my mind for the longest time, because I had no idea who Robin Williams was at the time. But Shields and Yarnell, we saw them all the time. And this was before their TV show. This would have been like 68, 69. And they were performing there at Union Square, and they were doing some wonderful stuff. And this fellow just kind of came out of the crowd and started performing with him. And I didn't know this until he was on the Actors Studio, but Robin Williams told the stories about having performed with them, and he would just be somebody out of the crowd that they would put in as a sort of a ringer. Mm-hmm. And so that was fairly early in his career. But San Francisco, there are mime theaters in San Francisco, and I'm thinking most especially if you go down around North Beach. Now, North Beach is now known essentially, you know, for some of the sleazier of entertainment. But there are some theaters still down there, and you can still go see those things. In fact, we went to one to see One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when Michael Douglas was performing it, and it was his first run down there. We'd gone to Ernie's one night for dinner and then gone to see that.
Yeah.
And theater is alive and well. ACT is still in San Francisco.
Of course, yeah.
It's tremendous.
And, you know, just to put in a pitch for mimes, because people, you know, mime, and it's the guy with the spray paint in the park. It's so much more.
That's an ancient art. It goes well back into the Greek years.
And if people want to see where mime is now, if they get a chance to, or you get a chance to, check out a guy named Billy the Mime. Have you ever heard of this guy?
No, I can't say I have.
His real name, I think, is Stephen Banks, and he's done a lot of comedy work, and he's basically the head writer for SpongeBob SquarePants, but his other thing is...
Oh, man, I want to whack... How come we didn't think of that? SpongeBob SquarePants? Give me a break. You know, the first time I said that, my kids were like... Well, my grandkids, I mean, are 4, 5, 6, something like that. I said, that's going to be a big thing, because it's so simple. It's kind of, you know, like the Pet Rock thing, you know?
Funny, and he's brilliant. But his alter persona, and he hasn't done this on Broadway, but off-Broadway he has and around the country. Some of his little pieces are on the internet at his website. If you go to BillyTheMime, I think, .net. And you see that he's taken mime into a very different direction. Sometimes a very controversial one, but it's wonderful stuff. And it's great to watch.
You know the old Harlequin? the
character.
Or the mimes that use that as their basis. I'm trying to think. There were some really famous ones back in the late 50s, and they were on television on Ed Sullivan at least a couple of times. But I always found that – I think that was my eye-opener, was to see and then, you know, learning where those – you know, goes back into France and so on, where that was. Yeah. But mime is one of those things, like reader's theater, that people don't understand. It's more than just a performing art. It's an ancient art, because reader's theater goes back to the Greeks too. There's a young woman that I worked with over at Windsor Community Playhouse named Christine Sturgis, who specialized and has a degree in reader's theater. And she has, you know, had time from time. We've talked about the history of it. That was one of the earliest forms of theater that was recognized as performing art. Yeah.
Because you would sort of appreciate this. I have another show that just blew my mind when I was going to see Broadway shows. And that was the first time I ever saw on stage Our Town. Now, you must know Our Town.
I love it.
I mean, it's just one of those. They even did, like, 2-3 weeks ago on CBS Sunday Morning, they did a piece about how important Our Town. It's more produced than really any other show, because it's just incredibly moving and beautiful when it's done right. And I had seen it on TV with Robbie Benson years ago, and maybe with the William Holden version, but I'd not really been cognizant of the play.
Do you remember who played the female lead in the William Holden version?
Jane Wyman? No.
Martha Scott. The woman that played Charlton Heston's mother in Ten Commandments.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
Okay. And yes. They weren't that many years apart. When was the Our Town? Like 30s or was it already 40s?
I'm thinking that was 43, 42.
Oh, that's right, because it wasn't written until...
You know, real quickly, you know, Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward did that on television for the 50th anniversary of Ford Motor Company when it did it. And Frank Sinatra was the stage manager.
Oh, my God.
Love and Marriage, that was written for that production.
For that, which is a totally wrong song. It was much more right for Married with Children than it was for Our Town.
But, you know, this tells you how they were trying to adapt. Ford Motor Company was celebrating their 50th anniversary of building motor cars, and they had this two-hour special, and it was Our Town. And, again, Frank Sinatra was the stage manager, but Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward played the young lovers.
Wow. And, of course, you know that the last Broadway production of Our Town, Paul Newman was the stage manager.
Yes, I did.
And they did tape that, and they showed that on public television.
And it's wonderful.
I did not get to see. I went to the wrong theater that night, and went to instead because it was opening around that time when a lot of shows were opening in the spring, and I like had my wrong calendar, so I ran to another show that I was supposed to see 2 days later and missed the Paul Newman Our Town, and I was so upset, and they couldn't get me.
I happened to meet he and Joanne Woodward once on the street in San Francisco, coming down the hill there by the Fairmount Hotel, and interestingly enough, I was leaving KSFO Radio, going over there, but I'd been working in San Francisco for the drug company. They were filming Towering Inferno, and they did all the filming at night, so I did a lot of my work at night, because during the day, you know, computer time was hard to buy during the day. It was very expensive, so I was buying time at a place called Data Specs, and we were running a lot of our stuff at night because we were creating some systems. But we could watch them out the window, you know, from the 19th floor or whatever, and watch them doing it with the fire wagons and all that stuff. But I came out of there, and I'm walking down the street, and what I noticed first off was that Joanne Woodward was walking on the outside as opposed to walking on the inside, you know, when you're walking with a woman on the street, you know.
Never understood all that, but my wife is...
I was raised that way. And I noticed, and he had this long blue overcoat, looked very expensive, and sunglasses, and it wasn't a particularly sunny day. And when I got closer, I recognized her first. And, you know, she has a striking presence, not as you would say beautiful, but there's a presence about her. You know that she's somebody important just by the way she carries herself and so on. And we got up a little closer. I just said, well, good morning, Miss Woodward. I hope you're enjoying San Francisco. You know, it's typical BS, you do.
Yeah.
And he takes the sunglasses and he tips them down and looks at me over the top of the sunglasses. Well, obviously, he felt slighted. I'm sure he felt slighted. I says, I'm so sorry. It's an honor to have you here in San Francisco, too, Mr. Newman. I hope you're enjoying yourself. And he put the glasses back on. We didn't. She just nodded and went on, and he went on. But I think that was a very telling moment when he peeks over the top of the glasses so I can see his blue eyes.
I can't imagine Paul Newman being kind of esteemed that he would not be recognized when walking with Joe. I mean,
well, let me tell you something. Sometimes that is an odd thing. Now, you know, you remember Sid Charisse, the beautiful dancer from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on? She was married to a fellow named Tony Martin, who incidentally was Alice Faye's first husband before she married Phil Harris. We were, my wife and I and my son were coming back from a camping trip. We'd been up around Shasta, and we pulled in, and we wanted to have a Shakey's Pizza at the Concord Mall out there in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, Concord. It's, you know, it's east of San Francisco ways. We're getting ready to go back to the car, and they have this, it's a beautiful glass-roofed mall, and they have these trees planted all over and these potted things with little benches and things set under them. And the escalators are on one end of the building, right? So I see this man who looks to be rather rotund with a striped golf shirt on, but it was striped horizontally, blue and white.
To make him look even
larger. Yeah, right. Like you could, you're thinking this guy's pretty big. Actually, it wasn't when he got up next to him. But as we got closer to them, it was Tony Martin, and I recognized him, who happens to still be alive. And I think he's living in a nursing home in L.A., but at the time they were living up on Snake Road in Oakland area, Oakland Hills. We get close enough to him, and I said, I'm kind of a gregarious person. I said, you know, Mr. Martin, it's a pleasure to see you. I put my hand out. Now, he nudges her, Sid Charisse, who was his current wife then, and was his wife till he died. She died.
Yeah.
Look who got recognized first. It was a little joke between them, you know, when they would go out into public. And I don't know if they got recognized very often, because we're talking, this was in the early 80s. But he nudges her and says, look who got recognized first. And they sat down and talked with Betty and I, and my son was about 9 or 10 at the time. Now, he was being a pain in the neck running around because he wanted to get back in a car. But they were just so nice to us. And they were, and my wife always says, you know, she had to be at least 72, 73 years old, and she was drop-dead gorgeous.
Good.
Okay. No makeup, nothing. Excuse me.
I haven't played any music in like 2 hours.
Yeah, Dave, I'm sorry to be rude about interrupting your story.
No. But, all right, let me finish the Our Town story.
Finish the Our Town story.
Because normally at noon we play a half hour Bob Dylan on this program because that's just what I do. So we kind of eschewed that, but I will play a little bit of Dylan.
Are you a Bob Dylan fan?
Fanatic. Yes, we're here looking at, well, the song was New Blue Moon, but we're looking at the relatively new Gil Moon here. University of Northern Colorado radio station, UNC Radio. Listenable on uncradio.com and also in the dorms at the university on Channel 3. And we've just been having an absolute blast having Gil from KFKA AM Radio here in Greeley, Colorado. In his honor, we played some Bob Dylan songs there. We usually do our Dylan set at noon. Got started a little late on it, but we heard Moonshiner, Moonlight from Love and Theft, Blue Moon, If You See Her, Say Hello. Well, that has those were the only three songs with Moon in the title, so then we had to go a little far afield and find some other stuff. So If You See Her, Say Hello, in which Dylan sings the line about sundown, yellow moon. And then Traveling Wilburys, of which Dylan was a part, New Blue Moon. Although I think that's the ELO guy doing the lead vocals on that. Who is the lead fellow from Electric Light Orchestra? Lynn, Jeff Lynn. So, anywho, but he's somewhere in the background.
You're asking me? You're asking me?
I am asking you. Well, no, you knew Dylan. I was a little surprised about that. No offense.
Well, that does sort of go back to the 60s, and that was my era.
So, anywho.
I noticed you didn't play any Glenn Miller or Tommy Dorsey or any of that.
Well, I had a lot more music I was going to play, but we got so into talking and all about the stuff you know about radio and Orson Welles and about Hollywood movies and pretty much everything else that, you know.
Oh, but you were telling this this really great story about our house, or our town, our house.
Our town.
Yeah, Wilford Brimley classic, Our House. You remember that? Are you old enough to remember that?
No, I don't.
It was a television show.
Okay. So, it was in response to your question of some of the best things I've ever seen on Broadway. And I told you that Our Town was one of them. And I wanted to tell this story particularly because on some level you'd appreciate it. Now, the first time I saw Our Town, and it completely blew me away and moved me to tears and all that, was the stars were Spalding Gray, if you remember the late Spalding Gray.
Yes.
He played the stage manager. And he took a little flack because they said he did it in a rather cynical way. He was almost ironically commenting on the material, which I did not see at all. I thought he was marvelous.
But that's not a bad idea.
It's doable, but yeah. I saw it. I didn't see it. I just thought he was really good. And then, do you know who the two leads were?
I can't wait.
Well, I mean, they're famous. They're not,
somebody I know?
You have heard of them. Eric Stoltz.
Oh, yeah.
The right-handed actor. And Penelope Ann Miller, if you remember her.
Yes.
They were fantastic. I mean, it was...
Now, where did you see this? In New York? In New York?
It was Lincoln Center. We're staging it on Broadway. Now, I loved it so much that I was working... I forget where I was at the time. I dragged a coworker because it was also kind of a theater guy. And I said, you got to see this production. Well, it was a few weeks later, or months later, and new cast, new people. So now the lead actress, the young woman playing Emily, was an actress named Helen Hunt, if you remember.
Is this the Helen Hunt?
The Helen Hunt. And the stage manager was played by Don Amici.
Don Amici, from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Right.
Yes.
It went from being the very best, one of the very best experiences I've ever had in the theater, to being one of the worst. And this is the reason. Don Amici, who had just come into the role, I guess, was an older gentleman at this point.
Yeah.
And either he came too soon, or he didn't learn his lines, or whatever. But within about 3-4 minutes, it was apparent that he was lost, that he did not know the script. And it's difficult because the stage manager doesn't interact with anybody. He's got to either know his line.
Yeah, but
there's no cues.
He's the conduit.
Right. So, I mean, he was on, and literally it was at the point halfway through the show where he would just say, shout line, and you would hear the line coming off stage from stage manager reading it. And I just, you know, I was looking, I was angry.
It must have been terribly embarrassing for him, too. Had he won his Academy Award yet by the time he did that?
Oh, yeah, this was after, I'm pretty sure this was after.
So he'd have been in his 80s then.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he looked great, and he sounded great.
Oh, yeah, he still looked good.
But you knew immediately that, uh-oh, he's repeating a couple of things, and then he just completely got...
Now, in a case awful. Like that, wouldn't it have been smart, wise, intelligent, whatever, to just simply hand him the script?
Yes, because he's a stage manager.
Why not do
anyway.
That? Yes.
Yeah. I don't know why they didn't think of that even for the second act. And he could have pulled it off. He could have gone through the whole thing with a script
and
in his
no
hand.
One would have known the difference.
Yeah. And people would have loved it because he had the voice, he had the presence. Instead, and I was rather amazed. I you know, because I was this close to booing at the end. I don't boo very often. But the audience still gave him a decent hand, and I was like, oh, no, do not reward this.
But at the Lincoln Center, that must have been terribly embarrassing.
Yeah. I mean, he went on. I guess he had been ended up learning his lines. And now, if you look at the stories coming out of New York, there are a lot of actresses and older folks who are using earpieces.
Oh, yeah.
Singles. Yeah. Angela Lansbury was using it.
There's actually a class that you could take for television, would-be commentators and news people, on how to do that. And our friend George Flynn is one of the teachers that teaches that class.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Because I can imagine it being distracting, but...
We need to bring George Flynn over here and do this show with him.
Yeah.
Do you have another... Yeah, you have three microphones here.
Sure, yeah.
You know, George is one of the most entertaining people you're ever going to meet in your whole life. And he knows story after story about radio, television, film. But with your knowledge of theater and George Flynn in the room with his knowledge...
And your knowledge of radio.
George is... George used to work for Hanna-Barbera, did the voices back when they had the Flintstones and the Jetsons
God.
And those things. Yeah.
Who did he...
I suspect it because of those were sort of troops of repertory artists that he may have done several of them one time or another, and they may not have always been the same person doing the voice, unlike a Family Guy where it's the same people all the time. But Hanna-Barbera had a whole different idea about it because they would teach people several voices,
right.
And they wanted to do that so they wouldn't be in the same mess what was his name, Mel Blanc, put Warner Brothers into. Without Mel Blanc, there was no Daffy Duck. There was no
Bugs
Bunny.
Yeah.
You know, Daffy Duck was essentially created to be the counterpart, the racial counterpart to Bugs Bunny. And if you look at how the two characters evolved, they're almost identical.
Wait.
Yes,
Daffy Duck was created in order to be a black person.
Yes,
a
black Bugs
Bunny.
A black Bugs Bunny, yeah.
What was the thinking about it? Because they weren't.
Well, because they were trying to appeal to a new audience, and it was one of those things that happened. Daffy Duck had appeared in two or three of those old Looney Tunes, and then they didn't show him for a long time. And then he came back, and it was really probably the late '50s, early '60s when it started to do it. But they wanted to appeal. They wanted to have that appeal. Mel Blanc has written a whole book on the evolution of those characters, Speedy Gonzales, which is now banned. They don't do that anymore. Yeah. But that was another one of those attempts that they did, that they brought in there to try to attract a different audience. So.
Oh, that's it never occurred to me that was.
Mel Blanc has a book out there, and I don't remember what the name of it is now. But his son is now doing most of those voices.
Sure. Well, Brian Henson mm-hmm. does the characters of the Muppets that Jim Henson used to do.
Now, there is a fella who is at a time probably was recognized by a certain segment of our population, but Sesame Street truly changed the world.
Oh yeah, oh my God, yeah. It was like the Beatles for the preteen set.
Yeah. And I'll tell you another fella that gets very little recognition, but Mr. Rogers. My son grew up, and I really give an awful lot of credit to Mr. Rogers for teaching certain aspects of social interaction that he learned from watching Mr. Rogers. Yeah. I mean, he takes off his shoes when he comes to the house or something like that. But no, but the whole idea was that was my son's generation, and he would sit there and talk back as they would.
Wait, how old is your son? Because
my son, he'll be 40. Generation. He'll be 40.
Yeah, okay. So I'm of that cohort. Yeah. Because I watch Sesame Street.
I think
when
we talk about that, aren't you just slightly younger than my son?
No, I'm 46. I'm older.
Oh, okay.
Significantly. But still, I remember the first episode.
Yeah.
I became a Sesame Street fanatic, and I remember watching Mr. Rogers.
Well, the trolley,
Yeah, yeah. Actually, Neighborhood Make-Believe was not my favorite part. I didn't want them to go to Make-Believe. I just wanted to hang with Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, he was cool.
Watch him feed the fish.
Well, you and Eddie Murphy. Hey, listen, you were talking about film in this area, and there is a wonderful film company called Shadow Play Films that runs out of Loveland,
mm-hmm.
and I'd be happy to take you over there to introduce you to a fellow named David Priest who runs it. It's part of the Grizzly Adams group now, and they do a lot of films. You'll see them on Hallmark TV and several. They make a lot of commercials. It's spiritual in nature for a lot of the things that they do.
Sure.
And I've done, maybe 12, 15 films for them over the years that I've lived here. But I have to say that that's another opportunity that people pass up. The independent film industry probably has a better audience now than it's had, in years. Because people want to see, especially with YouTube and those things, people want to see what other people's take is on things. And one of the examples that I will bring out, too, is that, if you put in Orson Welles into the video section on Bing or Google or any of those, there are tons of people out there who are imitating Orson Welles, doing pieces and bits and stuff that he had done. And a couple of them have even done shows with them. There's one down in Australia running right now, and there was one that ran in Chicago for a while, too.
Aren't you working on some level on Orson Welles?
Yeah, I'm doing it a little different, though. I'm taking, towards the end of his life. And most of it was inspired, I think, by my appreciation of that interview we talked about from 1984, because he could look in retrospect at the things that he had done well and not done so well. Barbara Leeming wrote a wonderful book that I'm listening to at the moment, The Life of Orson Welles, a biography, and she did it through 2 years of interviews with him, and there's stories in there that I hadn't even heard yet, and I've read just about everything that's ever been written about Orson Welles. My interview with Chrissy, his oldest daughter, off the air, she gave me a tremendous amount of insight to personal aspects. This was a really humble fella.
Orson Welles.
Yes, and you don't see that in anything that you see him do. He was always so self-confident to the extent that people thought he was arrogant, but he was really humble. And he, there's this incident between he and John Houseman where he threw the flaming dishes at Houseman at Chase's restaurant, and they supposedly split and, never worked together again. Well, that's simply not true. The idea that he threw the dishes at him is true. But a week later, they were having lunch at Sardi's, and, he worked with him and stayed with him through the end of Kane. The incident, though, that as it was depicted by Houseman in his autobiography, was far more dire than it was when Welles talks about it. Welles had an explosive temper, and if you've seen me and Orson Welles, you know that that's the case. I mean, that whole speech that he makes about, I am Orson Welles and this is going to be done my way thing, that happened. That probably happened.
Well, it has to. If he's going to be an auteur, if he's going to be the chief cook and butler.
That is the word of all words, auteur. That is exactly what he was.
Sure.
But he was so cocksure of himself. It's like he said, the word genius was whispered to me when I lay mewing in my crib. And it didn't even occur to me till I was 40 that I may not be one. Well, he was so sure of himself. And people don't like that. You've experienced that. I know you have. I have.
Well, no, it was a thing to think that you're smarter than you actually are. But the other side of it is,
what if you're not? What if you are smarter than you think you are?
I would rather be that.
I think you are. David, I've told you before, you and Joyce were a real bright spot coming into my life.
Oh,
and I just love you guys to death. But I have to say this, that you have a tendency to be overly humble about your own experience and your own.
That's just because I am so brilliant.
And I think you are. I think you are. You know, I'm looking forward to working with you if we ever do get the chance to sit down on my Orson Welles thing. But I consider it a real pleasure and honor to have been here with you this morning. Thank you for having me, David.
Well, thank you, Gil Moon. And we don't really have time to run through the list of the things that you're going to be playing on
Sunday night.
Sunday night. But tell people the two shows that they can listen to tomorrow on KFK.
Well, if you listen to Senior Circle from 10 to 11 tomorrow, we will have guests from Union Colony Dinner Theater as well as your own people here from, what's the name of that?
Bright Ideas,
the two stars of Bright Ideas. So they'll be on in the 10:30 hour, and they have a whole half hour then. Sunday night from 6 to 10, we have Superstition, 3 Out of Match from 1935, followed by Mysterious Traveler at 6:30, Out of the Past from 1944. At 7 o'clock, Mr. Ace and Jane with Jane and Goodman Ace. Did You Ever See a Dream Walking? And again, this is about horse racing from 1948. 7:30, The Incomparable Charlie Chan, Telltale Hands from 45. 8 o'clock, The College of Musical Knowledge with Phil Harris from San Luis Obispo, California. 1944 and 8:30, John Daner, Have Gun Will Travel, Hell Knows No Fury from 1960. At 9 o'clock, the Lux Radio Theater Whistle Stop with Alan Ladd and Evelyn Keyes from 1946. And once again, David Lefkowitz, thank you so much for having me here.